and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Marta Dychok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and this has been a busy time on the international scene. A lot of things have been happening that affect Ukraine. The Brussels, the EU-Ukraine summit, the NATO summit, and of course the Trump-Putin summit. To talk about what this means for Ukraine, we have an expert with us in studio. Brian Whitmore is Senior Fellow and Director of the Russia Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis, which is a Washington-based think tank, for those of you who haven't heard of it. He's a really top Russia analyst. He's an author of a very successful podcast called The Power Vertical, and a regular guest on our show, Ukraine Calling. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you, Marta.
Ahead of the summit, I read a piece that you wrote, a very strong op-ed in the Washington Post. The Russians are saying they've already won at the Trump-Putin summit, and they're right. Ukraine was only one of the issues in the U.S.-Russia story, but let's focus on that. What strikes me is that there seem to be mixed messages coming to Ukraine about Ukraine. On the one hand, the EU and the NATO at their summits, they reiterate their strong support for Ukraine, its territorial integrity, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, U.S. President Trump is all friendly with Russia. What should Ukrainian leaders make of this?
Well, I'd say the first thing I would say is that no policy has changed, and that the U.S. policy on Ukraine remains unchanged. The fact that the U.S. president seems to be seeking better relations with the Russians, and the way that summit meeting has turned out, may embolden the Russians right now, and that is certainly cause for concern for Ukraine. Also, right now, to put it very mildly, there's a bit of a transatlantic rift, and that is never good news for Ukraine. But on one hand, the policy hasn't changed. The policy hasn't changed.
But are we getting signals that it is possibly changing with everything that's coming out of U.S. President Trump's mouth?
I don't think so, because, again, the United States is bigger than the president. There's a policy in place, and that policy has not changed. So I would stress this. I mean, I think we have to be really careful now. We don't want to be too Pollyannish and say everything's okay, because things are clearly in a rather unusual state right now. But on the other hand, we don't want to be Chicken Little saying the sky is falling, because, again, the United States is bigger than its president. The transatlantic relationship is about more than presidents and prime ministers. It's about a community of values that's been in place for decades. And it is stronger than any one U.S. administration. But so we want to find that spot between those two things. We need to be concerned right now. There's certainly cause for concern. Anytime that the Russians feel emboldened is dangerous for Ukraine. But by the same token, the U.S. policy toward Ukraine has not changed, at least as far as I can see.
Well, that's actually pretty reassuring, because you probably saw this article in The Guardian that was titled, "Ukraine is the first casualty of Trump's carelessness," and Ukraine's president was tweeting right after that press conference that we're ready to defend our land even if we remain all alone.
Well, I think that has to be the attitude of the Ukrainian president. The Ukrainian president's responsibility is the security of the Ukrainian people. So I think I certainly hope that President Poroshenko is ready to defend Ukraine, even if it's alone. But I also would say at the same time, I certainly hope is not now and will never be alone.
So the signals that you saw coming out of that Trump-Putin summit, you don't think that there's going to be a shift in the policy?
I haven't seen anything to suggest that thus far. Ukraine has a lot of friends in the foreign policy establishment in Washington. Those friends are still there. And the policy remains unchanged. The United States still affirms the territorial integrity of Ukraine. And that has not changed. The shipment of defensive weapons has already begun to Ukraine. That has not changed. So I don't see a change in policy. What worries me are things like the optics. What worries me is that a summit like this will embolden Putin to think he might be able to try something in Ukraine, and that's what makes me nervous right now.
To try more things in Ukraine.
He's also trying many things, of course. But I think, again, the policy's not changed. And again, to reiterate my point, These are weird times, but we can't be too Pollyannish. We can't think everything's all right, nothing's changed, nothing weird is going on. But at the same time, we can't be thinking the sky is falling. We're a nation of laws, the United States is, as are our European allies. Those laws and institutions remain in place. We're bigger than our president. We're bigger than any president, not just this president. And so I think we're all trying to find that middle ground. We all should be concerned right now, but I think we have to be careful about panic and becoming too hysterical and be, you know, thinking the sky is falling, because I don't think it is yet.
You have a really good perspective because you're in Washington, but you travel a lot. You were just speaking at various conferences in Europe. The attitude towards Ukraine wasn't the focus of a lot of these things, but the Brussels summit, the EU-Ukraine summit, you know, there is this strong reiteration of support for Ukraine. Is this the same mood that you're hearing in Washington?
Well, yeah, among the Atlanticists in Washington, that is certainly what I'm hearing. I mean, support for people who understand security understand that the security of Ukraine is intimately tied to our security. Right? This isn't just about some kind of like what's the word I'm looking for? A charity to take, you know, because we should take care of Ukraine. Ukraine's security is intimately tied to ours. All one has to do is to study the history of the 1930s and the 1940s to understand what happens when the security of small states, and Ukraine is not really a small state, it's as big as France, but it is smaller than its more aggressive neighbor to the east. All one has to do is study the history of the 30s to understand what happens when the security of smaller states is up for grabs and is seen as a bargaining chip among great powers. We've seen what the world descends into. So the security of Ukraine, the security of Georgia is intimately linked to our security. The people in Washington who are Atlanticists and understand security get that. And so I think that is unchanged. The same people that were supporting Ukraine under this administration were supporting it under the last administration. They remain, their voices remain strong. So I think this is something that we have to bear in mind.
Some of the analysis that I've been coming across, Ukraine seems to be an object of international affairs rather than a subject. That this big power play between Washington and Moscow, Ukraine is sort of being treated as, well, who's going to be influencing and not influencing. And at the G7 summit back in June in Quebec, there was talk about readmitting Russia back into the G7, coming again from President.
Well, the only talk about that was coming from President Trump, and that was quickly dismissed by the other six members of the G7. So, there was talk. There wasn't really any, but there was. It only came from one person. Nobody is seriously considering readmitting Russia to the G7. That's not going to have any traction.
So this concern that the Western alliance is cracking is something not to worry about too much. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying the Western alliance is going through a difficult patch right now. And again, we should be concerned. But the Western alliance is bigger than any one U.S. president. It's bigger. The Western alliance isn't just about prime ministers and presidents. I mean, look at the conflict that erupted between the Prime Minister of Canada and the U.S. president prior to the G7 summit. But I saw what Prime Minister Trudeau said, and he said the American people, we disagree with these tariffs, but the American people remain our friends. Now, I think that's about right. The Canadian-American relationship, I certainly hope, as an American of Canadian descent, is strong enough to withstand anything that may happen between their respective leaders of the two countries. I feel the same way about the transatlantic relationship.
I've sort of lost track of what's happening with the Canada-U.S. trade tensions.
No, I've lost track of the minutiae of it, but I know the Prime Minister of Canada announced that there will be retaliatory tariffs.
Absolutely.
But he made a point of reiterating, this is not about the American people. The American people remain our friends. America remains our partner. I thought that was exactly the right tone that Prime Minister Trudeau struck. I mean, he always makes me proud to be a North American. But I thought that was the. But more importantly, this goes to the fact that the Canadian-American relationship is deeper than that and cannot be derailed by any comments that any American president or Canadian prime minister makes. I think the same thing has to be stressed about the transatlantic relationship, that this is a very deep relationship based on values and based on shared values across the Atlantic. And it's stronger than any U.S. president and will survive any U.S. president. So I think that we're going through a tough patch right now. And that this also does reflect, and I think amid all the noise, I think this does reflect a debate that's been going on in the United States about the degree to which the U.S. should bear the burden of European defense.
Which is kind of an old discussion.
Which is a very old discussion. This goes back to the Clinton administration and even earlier.
Even earlier, absolutely.
And this is a very old discussion. I think where this discussion about the 2% is the 2% is kind of an arbitrary figure, but it's a legitimate debate.
It is a very legitimate debate, absolutely.
It has to bring into consideration things like, you know, other things the European allies do for us. Ramstein Air Base is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, air base in the world. And this is a chunk of territory the Germans are just letting us have. So when we're talking about burden sharing, there's a lot of things that can come into this other than just a number. But we're going through a rough patch right now. A lot of it is the result of the rhetoric that's coming out of the White House. But I think that this relationship is strong and that it'll endure. And what this means for Ukraine, well, Ukraine does better when you have a strong Euro-Atlantic relationship. So there is cause for concern right now. Any rift between the United States and the European allies is bad for Ukraine.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you've been following, but there's been reports that Russia is increasing its presence in the Sea of Azov. And people here are concerned about, you know, what could this mean? Is this potentially further escalation at a time when the Euro-Atlantic partnership is going through a difficult time? For Ukraine, this is a huge concern because they're still trying to get into these institutions, and they're on the one hand being welcomed, but on the other hand, they're facing this very real threat every day where people are being shot at and killed in fear of escalation. And then you see Putin and Trump smiling. So people here are getting really very nervous.
No, the Sea of Azov thing concerns me. I actually did a vertical video on it that will be coming out in the next day or so.
We'll post a link to it on our show because I can't wait to see it. But let's hear what you have to say.
I basically started with some comments Putin made during his press conference with President Trump, in which he said, "We held a referendum in Crimea." Who the hell is we? In this situation, according to the Putinist mythology, it was the people of Crimea that of their own accord had a referendum on the status of Crimea. Now, we know this is not true. We, you and I. But I thought it was interesting that after the fact, the Kremlin changed the official transcript on this and took the "we" bit out.
So it was a slip of the tongue.
It was either a slip of the tongue, or it was arrogance, or it was carelessness. But they did remove this from the transcript. But as this was all going on, it looks like Russia's not trying to just annex Crimea. It looks like they're trying to annex the Sea of Azov, because according to Ukrainian sources, no less than 148 vessels, Ukrainian and foreign, have been stopped in those international waters. And Russia is now trying to treat the Sea of Azov like its private lake, but the Sea of Azov is international waters. And this would cut off Mariupol from access to the Black Sea, which could have devastating consequences for Ukraine's economy, let alone for international law. These are supposed to be international waters, but Russia's treating the Sea of Azov like its private lake. This has been going on for the better part of a year, as Russia was building the Kerch Bridge.
They're periodically
closing this. But now it looks like they're trying to
actually cut it off.
Cut it off. And that's something that certainly should be on our radar screens here in the West. This is about the...
But again, what can Ukraine do about this, and what kind of Western help or interference?
President Poroshenko has announced, according to what I've seen, that the Ukrainian naval escorts are going to start escorting commercial ships. Now, what that portends, I don't know.
Well, this is another David and Goliath story, because the Ukraine's...
This is another David and Goliath story, but are we going to start to see conflicts on the high seas here? It's something to certainly keep an eye on. And how is the West, how is NATO going to respond to this? I mean, the free navigation of the Sea of Azov, the Kerch Straits, and the Black Sea is certainly in our interests. And so I'm very curious to see how the Western alliance responds to this. Again, this is another example where the security of Ukraine isn't just about Ukraine. It's about all of the security.
What does your crystal ball say? What do you think the response might be?
Well, I certainly hope that the alliance is concerned about the free navigation. I'm not sure what I think is going to happen, but I certainly hope the alliance views the free navigation of the Sea of Azov, the Kerch Straits, and the Black Sea, because this is basically what we're talking about, is access to the Black Sea. If we allow Russia to treat the Sea of Azov like a Russian lake today, does that mean we're going to allow them to treat the Black Sea like a Russian lake tomorrow?
That's the question. And that sort of takes me back to your op-ed that, you know, you said that it seems like Putin has already won just by getting this summit, and that he's basically getting away with everything that he's done. And there don't seem to be very serious consequences apart from statements, apart from sanctions. It seems like he's moving forward and nobody's really doing very much to stop him. And there's no end in sight.
Well, I thought what the message that this was pre-summit that I wrote this, that the message was extortion pays. The message was extortion pays.
And violence and I did this, pays.
Yeah, but I mean, effectively, I would say that Putin has turned Russia into an international protection racket that is basically going to, because we have this binary choice out there right now where we're saying we have to have good relations with Russia or else there's going to be war.
But there is
right?
war.
There's this, well, no, I mean,
a bigger war,
right? That Russia is going to wreak havoc until we give it what it wants. And so, I mean, this is effectively geopolitical extortion. Now, what did Russia get out of that meeting other than the optics, which were incredibly good for Russia? We don't know, because we don't know what happened behind closed doors. And I mean, nobody knows.
Don't you wish nobody we could knows. Know with that translator? I wish we could, like, talk to the translator and make them tell us what happened, but I don't think that's realistic.
Well, yeah, I don't even know the legalities of that. And quite frankly, I was watching the news over the past couple of days. I don't think the people in the Senate who are talking about this even know, because this is unprecedented. We've never been in a place like this before.
Well, sort of like the rest of the world, right? It's like things are happening that are crazy and we need to figure out how to respond to them.
Yeah, but I mean, and I'll have to remain kind of agnostic on that right now. We have probably the best law enforcement official of my generation and perhaps any generation working on this in the U.S. We're going to have to wait to see the results of his investigation. And I would say we can't say that nothing is going on, because we do see an indictment that came down this week for this 29-year-old Russian woman, Maria
Lukina. Yeah, that's such
who's
a
been
great
indicted
story.
For mm-hmm. who's been indicted for operating as a foreign agent on the U.S. soil without registering as a foreign agent. It's not an espionage case yet. She's being charged with working as a foreign agent without registering, because you can work as a foreign agent in the United States if you register. As a foreign agent. She was a student, a graduate student at American University, but was apparently trying to infiltrate certain political organizations, including the National Rifle Association, on behalf of the Russian government. We'll see how that turns out, but this to me signifies a new degree of assertiveness with American law enforcement. This is not part of the Mueller investigation. This is a separate thing. It's the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia brought this case forward. So it's happening here in D.C. Last week, we saw the incredibly detailed indictment from the Mueller investigation against these 12 Russian GRU officials, which is much, these people are never going to see the inside of a United States courtroom. But the fact that this indictment was brought was a signal, I think, to Russia that we see what they are doing in amazing detail. If you read that indictment, it's pretty amazing, the details it goes into. And I think this was also a signal to Russia. So the American system is working. Again, we're a nation of laws, and it's working. The system is, to a degree, is working right now. I have no reason to believe it's not.
Reason from Washington. Don't worry so much about what President Trump says and then retract his statements, but look at the laws, look at the system.
Pay attention to what we're doing. Now, that does not say, you know, let's be Pollyannish and say everything's all right.
No, God, no.
Because that's not the case. Everything isn't all right right now. It's far from all right. But I think we have to refrain from panicking at the same time.
Well, I think that's a very nice note to end on, and I hope that the Ukrainian leadership is reflecting that same thing and being careful and being strong but not panicking and believing in the system.
Well, Marta, one thing I want to add before we wrap up, because I did spend last week teaching at the Warsaw Euro-Atlantic Summer Academy, which is sponsored by the Council of the College of Europe. And one thing I saw there gave me cause for a lot of optimism, and that was the most active participants in this academy from where I was sitting were the young Ukrainians and young Georgians.
And who were these? These were students? These were government officials? Who were these people?
These were a mix of journalists, civil society activists, and practitioners in foreign and defense ministries. So it was a combination. But what I saw there was a generation of Georgians and Ukrainians, and when they get their chance to be running the show, we're going to be all right. Really, let's face it, we're still seeing post-Soviet elites running these two countries. Well, what I was able to witness there, it's the same thing I witness every time I come across Ukrainians and Georgians of this generation. I'm filled with optimism because these people are indistinguishable from other Europeans. And they are not post-Soviet. They are not post-post-Soviet. They are Europeans. And once this generation is running the show in Ukraine and Georgia, we're all going to be all right. I mean, I'm just hoping we can get Ukraine and get Georgia to that day where this generation has their chance. Because if they have their chance, we're all going to be fine.
Brian, that's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Brian Whitmore. My name is Marta Dychok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Brian's new podcast is coming up. When's your podcast being posted, Brian, so we can share
it? Every Friday.
Friday, okay. And let's talk again about this and that positive energy of the new generation. Let's hold on to that. At night, Vnuchi. That's the name of a new song by the Kyiv rock pop band, The Frunk. They're doing a lot of live performing this summer at various festivals and in clubs. For those of you who can't see them live, here's their song that's making the charts in Ukraine. Enjoy.
Ніч, темніша за каву і вино, кіно провалиться знову в прокаті тиша. Більш мертва, ніж мила давно, як спритно стрілки на циферблаті. Далеких вокзалів.
Join us again next week when we'll bring you another in-depth interview and some more music. Tune in, and we'd be very happy to hear some feedback from you. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @callingukraine, or write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Marta Dechok in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.